Welcome to the First Intuition Podcast. On this episode, we welcome back Steve Williams, cybersecurity consultant for LNDSR. He answers our live audience questions on social media security and gives us some strong hints and tips on how to stay safe online. Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the First Intuition Podcast. My name is Ben Bullman, tutor and director at FI. I'm running solo this evening because my good friend and colleague Dave can't join us tonight. He is sadly at home in isolation with his family, and we wish him all the best. And I know a lot of the live students in the audience this evening have been putting nice comments and wishes for Dave and his family in the chat box. So if you're listening to this, as I'm sure you will be, Dave, when it's released, we're thinking of you, mate, and we want you back as soon as you are fit and able to rejoin us. But I have got a special guest with me this evening, so I will introduce him again. If you are a regular listener to the podcast, hopefully you caught his previous episode. If you haven't, it is well worth going back and listening to it now. But I'm going to say good evening to Steve Williams. Good evening, Steve.
Good evening, Ben.
So Steve is now a friend of the podcast. We can call you that because we've had you back. We obviously liked what you said last time. We definitely did. Thank you so much for giving up your time to come and talk to us. We don't pay or do any commercial arrangements with our guests. They are all voluntary, coming to do this out of the kindness of their heart. Steve, we can now call you maybe our resident cybersecurity expert.
Oh, look at this. I've gone from friend of the show to resident. This is the sky's the limit here, Ben. The sky's the limit.
So Steve's a director at LNDSR, and you advise businesses in a whole manner and range of cybersecurity thoughts, concepts, ideas, don't you?
Sure, that's correct. Yes, we have a range of clients from large corporates through to small, medium-sized businesses, and also some services we have will suit individuals as well.
And last time you were with us, we talked around cybersecurity, around crimes, and particularly looking at phishing scams, which were prevalent over the lockdown period and are likely to continue, if we're being honest. When we'd finished that episode, Steve said, I'd really like to do something on social media. And I think you listened to a previous episode of the podcast where we were massively endorsing the use of social media to develop careers, build a network and connections. And Steve, you said to me, that's a great message, Ben, but just make sure students and people are being careful around the security elements and the potential pitfalls that people can fall into around the use of social media.
Yes, there were a couple of comments on our previous podcast. I haven't gone back and listened to it preparing for this, unfortunately, but it tied in with the last session that we did, and that was really around phishing and the association of you as an employee of your organization on social media and the amount of information which can be unwittingly leaked or available for people to target you and then put you in the frame for phishing scams. So this session, I think, is a slightly different way. We're looking at the use of personal social media accounts in collaboration with employers' opinions and how to separate work and your personal social media activities.
Fantastic. And we'll certainly touch on that later on as we look at the blurred line sometimes between your personal life on social media and your professional persona and what your employer might see and think. But let's go back and think about crime first of all. Why would a criminal potentially be interested in my or one of our students or listeners' social media accounts?
So there's a couple of us. It's a good question. There's a couple of reasons. There is no one single reason. I think really to set the frame for this is to paint a picture of the cybercrime landscape, if you will. People will often think of hackers and attackers and assailants as an individual who is tapping away, trying to guess the password for an account of yours or an email account to try and siphon something off. And that's whilst that is true, but the cybercrime landscape is very much an industry. There are different levels, different areas of the industry. And to be fair, a lot of people don't look at this threat this way. So within the cybercrime landscape, you will have people who fulfill different roles. They have different skill sets. They have different objectives as to what they want to get. Not everybody is out to guess your Facebook password. It doesn't quite work that way. You'll have some groups which will look to gain data. They will look to get data, various different types of data. This could be access to your social media accounts, could be access to or details of your credit cards. It could be passwords. It could be information addresses where you live. You have some people who are data gatherers. You have other people who would then take information like that and either leverage it or sell it or pass it on to somebody else, another group, in favor or part exchange for other services. You also have other areas of the cybercrime landscape which will provide services to other attackers. So if you wanted to compromise or launch an attack across Netflix to look at accounts that you've got some details for, you will have some people who will have infrastructure, servers, anonymized servers, multiple different routes, and they will provide that, they will rent that out to cyber gangs in order to be able to use those services in exchange for currency, cryptocurrency, hard currency, or other information. So just to frame that, there are different components of the industry, and where you become a victim and your data is used and gets put into that ecosystem can go through many different hands of people trying to earn revenue from gaining the data in the first place, selling that on in large bundles, large quantities, and push that through. So why would somebody be interested in your social media account? Apart from that saleable item in the ecosystem, you have other areas where you have people who will try and get that personal information. You have other areas where people will look to try and destroy a brand. So we're looking at your personal social media account, but you can also apply this to your employer's Twitter account, their Facebook account, their Instagram account. People can look to take over those accounts and do damage, brand damage, to the organization that you work for. They may well hold that to ransom, or they may well just look to deface that. There are other areas where you can have, it's a tactic called forced shares. If anybody here on the call is a Instagram influencer, you are a counting genius, and you have hundreds of thousands or millions of followers, a breached account in that aspect, then they can push out a link to make it look as if it's come from you, an endorsement of another site, or to follow this particular account or pay attention to that. That gains a lot of sway before somebody's come back and said, hey, my account was hacked. That's one method. Another method is a forced follow. And this is quite interesting and quite unique, a little niche, where they will, after gaining access to an account, they will look to follow a particular company or a Instagram handle, Twitter handle, which will look something similar to something that you followed before. And at some point, they can do many things with this. They can either reply to you. You will believe that it's somebody that you have followed before. You can respond to that, or they can use that as some form of an endorsement because you and your account has followed it. It's a little bit more niche, but there are many different angles as to what they can actually do.
Wow, there is so much there, and it almost makes you think, as soon as we've left the call, we'll all go and delete all of our social media accounts. But obviously, then you've got to balance that with all of the good stuff that it does, connections with friends and family, people that maybe you can't see because they're on the other side of the world, or over the last 50 months you couldn't see because we were all locked down in our own backyards and we couldn't go and see people. The connections it's used to find employment or improve your professional network. So it's a real balancing act. And I guess like many things in life, it is that sensible use of social media and doing a few maybe simple things that just substantially reduce the risks of using it.
That's true. Some of the issues we see, and we can, I suppose, round this all up in that particular response for this, is how people have used social media accounts, the things that they have posted in the past, and how this reflects back on their employer. There is a fine line between having a personal account and having nothing to do with your employer and being seen as a visible employee of a company, and people then would say, this is the caliber of person your company and your employer employs, and we can then deduce that the behavior of that person on their personal social media accounts in some way reflects on their employer. Yes, in an ideal world, we would like to say that these things are poles apart, but depending on your position within a company and depending on who the company is, rightly or wrongly, people can deduce these things. So it's what you post and what you have posted. If somebody is willing to go through and dig up that history and then make a very tenuous connection between you and an employer, it can become uncomfortable. But there are ways of making sure that there is some form of separation and a break between those two. We can look at Instagram and Facebook are two channels which have some ability for you to be able to do this. Twitter is a little binaural, where you can hide your tweets and then you have to approve somebody to view those, or they're public. That's really all you've got as far as Twitter goes. Instagram does have a feature where you can have a close list, so close friends. They're the only ones who will see the posts that you actually put out to that particular list, and everything else is going to be public. So you can look to move things in that way to differentiate things that you want your employer to see and other things that friends would like to see. Facebook has, strangely enough, probably the most granularity with this. If anybody still uses Facebook, I know it's the domain for balding middle-aged men, I think, at this point, that's Facebook. But if you're a Facebook user, certainly the one thing that I do advocate, and I tell everybody who will listen and a few people who won't, that groups is your friend on Facebook. So you may want to create three groups on Facebook. You may want to have work, friends, and family. And once you've created those three groups, you go through your friends and you shuffle everybody into a particular bucket. And then that way you can make certain posts and then attribute that purely for work. Your work colleagues who you've connected with on Facebook will see that post. You can send other posts out to family meetings or flyers for get-togethers and things like that. That will go out to family. Your work colleagues and your other friends will not see that post. It will just go purely to that particular group. And likewise for friends, for anything jokey that you think is not really on a professional peer that you would want your work colleagues to see. And you have the ability, when you make a post, you have a drop-down box and you can select who you want to see this. You can select your groups, you can have everyone, you can make it public. So this will go to everybody outside of your friends group. So strangely enough, for all of the press that Facebook gets, they have one of the more granular frameworks to be able to divide and separate up different areas of your life by using groups. That's my main takeaway that I would tell a lot of people on the point of this question.
So let's break it down into some more practical steps people can take. And I guess the first one is the sorts of information that you are giving out to anyone potentially that can access your social media account. So I will see from time to time friends and connections I'm with, and I still use Facebook, but I'm probably in the demographic that you referred to earlier that will still be using Facebook. But I guess these things exist on Instagram and other platforms as well. I'll see friends following some kind of post around trying to gather information, I presume, branded as maybe a mini quiz, but actually it's putting information out there. What's your favorite film? What was your school or something? Are those there for fun, or are they there to kind of target? Because I think, well, actually, that's interesting, because that was the backup question I just gave to a password in case I ever lost it.
Very rarely for fun. I can think of funnier questionnaires to put it out rather than asking people the types of question that you would have in security questions. Yes, they're very rarely for fun, but it does highlight a point. And I had this conversation with a family member actually over the weekend, and it was some guidance for answering security questions. So this applies for Facebook, this applies for your bank, applies for your electricity company, your phone company, where they have a challenge response. They have these set questions: what's your mother's maiden name, what's the name of your first pet, which city were you born in? And they are looking for an answer. What we instinctively do when we see these questions is we want to answer them honestly, because that's how you're going to remember. Somebody asks you, what's your mother's maiden name? You immediately think your mother's maiden name. That's the answer you gave. But what the company is really trying to do is they are looking to get a memorable word that you know in order to prove your identity. So the conversation I had with a family member is, you answer the questions, but you do not answer the questions with the most intuitive answer. So you can say, what's your mother's maiden name? And you can say television. You can say, which city were you born in? And you could say green grass. What's the name of your first pet? 1, 2, 3, 8, 9. You can give a different answer. As long as you remember what those answers are, you can then respond to the challenge response, but you're not giving away any personal data, which could be gleaned by looking at your social media profiles, your date of birth, your star sign, or anything like that.
That's a really interesting thought process to kind of double bluff the question, because you're right. The natural reaction is, oh, I'll remember that one. That's the one I'll pick. But actually, that's probably the one that more people would be aware of and you're more likely to have on display somewhere else. Absolutely. So following on that theme, is there anything else that you see on people's social media profiles that you think, dull, why have they put that on their profile for the world to see? Any other information that we should be careful of guarding?
Oh, Ben, there is a ton. I think the stranger things, there's a lot of things which fall under common sense. And there are some things which, with all the best will in the world, people just didn't even think that people would be using that kind of information. There, especially on Instagram, there is a wealth of information that people will get from pictures, from images that you'll post. This could be selfies, this could be pictures with friends, family, and it's often things that are in the background, or things that you've actually taken a picture of. I have seen people getting their driving license through happily, that they've actually passed the test. They've got this great, they've taken a picture of their driving license, and that's that gone. So you've got your profile picture out there, you've got your date of birth, you've got your address on there, you've even got your driving license number. That's a very big no-no. We've seen holiday tickets, we have seen plane tickets. The situation that happened at Wembley on Sunday, where there were people who were already in seats when people had paid a lot of money to get through. This is before they've actually stormed the turnstiles. We believe that in some of those situations, and it's a very old hack that I really haven't seen appear in great detail for many, probably over 10 years, where people were going on holiday, very excited that they were finally heading off to wherever they're going, Tenerife, Magaluf, Ibiza. Can't wait for it. Take a picture of the plane tickets. We're now off. That's absolutely great. Where scammers will replicate the tickets, they will duplicate barcodes, they will get the information, they'll get the booking number and the flight number, your name as it is on the ticket, and either replicate the tickets and or be able to contact the travel agent, the booking agent, then amend that booking to some degree and transfer that over to a different name, different person. And before you know it, your all-inclusive holiday has gone. You get to the airport and you'll not be able to use your tickets. We've seen things like this. So it's the more counterintuitive things that people might not think about when you're taking pictures. If you're taking selfie pictures, it's everything that's in the background. If you've got a certificate, an award with your real name on it posted behind in the mirror, we've seen that. Or even, as some of your students may well actually see with certificates, they'll take a picture of that. I've passed a lot of great hard work and they want to share that. Some of these certificates and awards that you actually have will often have a full name on there. They have some other valuable information. It's the things that you post which have information in the background or not quite obvious from the first sight. You've got a new car, registration numbers. You take a picture outside your house, you've got the house number behind you in the picture. It's all of those things, which is data that you're unwittingly giving away.
And I suppose the people looking at it have got time to deep dive and really join up some of those dots that you think, well, actually that connected to that is not going to be followed through, but they've got plenty of time to do that.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's now explore the link back to work a bit more, because I think it's a really important one. And obviously something that's very, very topical at the moment. We couldn't preempt the horrible situations that we've seen following the football match and the England game on Sunday with the social media abuse of the players and racist abuse, which is abhorrent and really needs to be clamped down. But let's go back to thinking about work. Let's ask a simple question first. Do you think it's a good idea to mention your employer on your social media page? Because a lot of students would say, well, my employer's got a social media page, so surely they want social media interaction. Should we be naming the businesses that we work for?
Absolutely. There is a balance, I think, as you'd mentioned before. There are risks in everything that we do, and social media is no different. To mention where you work is a personal choice, whether you want to do that. If you're proud of the employer you work for, they do good work, and you're proud to be associated with those, then absolutely, this is great stuff. It becomes a little bit contentious where your views and how you use social media, whether your employer has that kind of overview and has the same line of thinking as yourself. So where you touched on the situation at the weekend, where there was a lot of abuse hurled at players and generally everybody around from the England team. Some people, for whatever their mindset was to post things like that, then thought that it was perfectly okay and great to do that from their own personal social media accounts. That's immediately going to get traced back to you, and your employer will see that. If you have the situation, as I just mentioned, I can see there in the chat, yes, a few weeks back, Chris Whitty, the government health minister, was harassed in the park, and the two guys that did that thought that was a smart idea to post that on some social media channels with their faces in there as well. One of them was an estate agent for a few more days after that was actually posted, and his employer immediately distanced themselves and said, this is not the behavior that we want to be associated with or anybody working with us. This is not our thing, and dismissed him for gross misconduct. we've seen again with the connections over the weekend and the racist abuse that Savills has taken immediate action for launching investigations for people in their employ who were in their employ who were wrapped up inside that. So the mixture of mentioning your company and your employer, absolutely so. But there is a responsibility to just be good people, I suppose, on the internet, and how that's going to reflect on your employer as well, as to whether there is anything, not just necessarily what you do post, but things historically that you may well have done. If you have a social media account for 5-6 years and your first couple of tweets or pictures were things that you probably wouldn't post now, if you haven't gone back, cleanse that account, or they are there to see, and some people can draw a conclusion between what you have done in the past, rightly or wrongly, and conclude that's the kind of person you are now. So it's not just what you do say now, what you have posted in the past can have long-term repercussions. Yes.
And that's a slightly different angle, but we were chatting before we came on air tonight about employers, and your feeling was there's now going to be more of a pressure or a requirement that employers will want to do some social media screening on potential staff.
When Bennett had reached out to me to follow up this this other podcast and this other session, we couldn't have foreseen what was about to happen in the following few days from that. And just before this started, we were talking about that occurrence and work. My organization does have a service which provides a vetting and a scan for social media accounts. This is not for this particular purpose in mind that we were looking at, but it was more an executive search to look back at their social media footprints to see if their thoughts align, whether they were sympathetic to particular employers, particular government positions that might not align with an organization. But it goes back through the trail of their social media accounts and gives that person, gives the company an idea of who this person is. Alternatively, and also we also offer that service to sporting organisations and to individuals, not necessarily just sportsmen or high profile people, to do that themselves. So they will say, okay, I'm now looking to branch out in a particular different way, or I'm looking for a transfer, or even football clubs are looking to make sure that their staff have a clean bill of health, to go back through those, look and identify things which they may have done and said in the past, which no longer applies to the people they are today, and brings that up before it gets presented in a more unfortunate manner, where they hadn't thought about their previous actions and thoughts. That is a service that we offer, and it's not to pump the service here, but yes, more forward-thinking organizations and individuals, depending on who you are and your status and your work career, if you're looking to take that next step to put yourself out to non-executive board directors, to be directorships, to be that candidate for the next step up. And I think this will apply for everybody here on this call, these students, is that when you're looking to make that next step, you just need to make sure that you're fitting the bill and ticking the boxes for every position that you're going to apply for. This may seem slightly irrelevant now, but it's certainly in the future. Having that clean bill of health, that double check on your profiles and what you have and what you haven't said, can get you a long way, and it can certainly stop you very quickly from going further.
Steve, I think that's a really important message, knowing how much time, dedication, energy our students put into passing exams to hopefully develop their future careers. It would be horrible if all of that is undermined by things that are being done now on social media that could come back to haunt you in another 2, 3, 5, 10 years when you're looking for a step up to those senior management board level positions. So I think we all need to be very careful and think about it as potentially a problem for the future that can be caused today. So I think it's a really important message, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's just think about work and time on social media, I suppose. What's your thoughts on using work devices, maybe devices that are shared with other people? I'm also thinking back, and I don't know now whether many students have been doing this in the pandemic, but it might come back to the time that we're going back into, I don't know, public libraries, and you just access a computer to check your social media account. I know most of us have got smartphone-enabled devices now that can access them. What are some of the risks of accessing personal social media on a device that's not your own?
It's an absolute no. Absolute no. You can see this maybe less now, but you can see if you just walk through any Apple store and you see that people have logged into a social media account to post something from a display MacBook in a store, or as you say, libraries, airports less so, but when you're using a public computer, you are entering in your credentials, and even if you do log out, you have no way of knowing the integrity of that particular machine, whether that has been compromised, there are any key loggers on there. It's something that you most certainly wouldn't do. You don't necessarily need to be paranoid to be thinking along like this, but yes, in public areas, you absolutely do not put any account details into any machine that you do not own and you don't know. That the origins of who owns it, where it's been, and where it's going to go to. On work machines, it's a slightly different angle from this. So you may well note that some employers will have security policies, acceptable use policies, where it's okay to use your laptop for internet browsing for either certain periods of time, or they will allow you to do that. There will be some acceptable use policies. They may even have content firewalls, content filters in place if you're going for a VPN to prevent you from going to particularly unsavory sites or other things which just don't fit with the work profile. So this could be Ladbrokes, Coral, any betting sites, anything like that, TV streaming, they may well block. And while you might be able to get through to Facebook accounts and social media accounts in general, it's entirely feasible that your employer would be looking at usage over the internet connection. And if they do see that for the 8 hours that you were actually working, that you were actually constantly pinging out to the Facebook site for six of those, you could end up having a question to answer. So it's most certainly something that I would be mindful of, really, just from a perspective of we can all multitask, but bosses would prefer you be doing more than one task for them rather than doing one task for you and one for another. So that is, from a work perspective, I would most certainly say that that's probably a more key aspect. But certainly if it's not your own laptop to log into something, and even if the credentials are stored on there, that's an even worse day that you're likely to have.
The other thing that springs to my mind, Steve, I would imagine most of the listeners and me access our social media platforms on our mobile phones because they're with us, it's easy. But then I look at my daughters. I don't do this as regularly now because I'm not so precious, but my daughters are all about getting the latest iPhone model and upgrading, and my wife upgrades and she will pass her phone on to one of the girls. But I'm also conscious that you can go online and maybe sell your used phone. You can trade it in. You can go to the sites that buy them. What are some of the risks there? And have you got any recommendations for what people should be doing if they are going to give up their previous device to somebody else?
Yes, absolutely. The situations where you're looking... Okay, so take a couple of steps back there. One of the things that you really should be mindful of when you're not just for social media, but that's a more an acute point where you have social media accounts, you have information, you have contact information for your friends and family on your phone, is to be able to apply security updates and update the apps, apply patches to that. It sounds the boring thing to do, but But that's really the key part for trying to make sure that you keep your mobile device safe. This could be your personal phone, could be a tablet, could be a laptop. Where we have some situations where phones have a certain lifespan, and the manufacturer, the vendor, be it Apple, be it Samsung, Huawei, anybody who, they would support a phone for a certain period of time. After that, they will stop providing updates and they'll stop providing security updates for it. Now, Samsung, I believe, have now extended this to 3 years that they support models for. Previously, they made an announcement where it was only going to be 2 years. And the implications of that is where you don't get security updates for your phone, that leaves vulnerabilities on your phone. And this could be compromised by malicious apps if they are downloaded. These are more prevalent in the Google Play Store for Android devices than they are for iPhone apps. But iPhone apps, iPhones are not completely exempt from any malware at all. They're very strict, but they're not completely 100%. So if you have a situation where you're compromised and you've got an older phone, you've not applied the patches to that, you're leaving more vulnerabilities on that phone. And that could compromise the data and the accounts that you have whilst you're on there. So it's mindful, best to be mindful to try and ensure that if you have a good mobile phone deal, you can upgrade your phone in line with your monthly payments or whatever, every year, every 2 years, whatever that is to do that to make sure that you have a device which can receive security updates. I think the point you mentioned there before, Ben, was reselling phones. When you do that, if you do, it's always advised to remove the memory cards if you have those in your phone, because that is more likely where your backups are going to be taken or put to your contacts, your social media. But to do a factory wipe of the phone, and that will restore it back through to the status it was when it came out of the box. Granted, a little grubby, a few more fingerprints on it and a few more dents, but the actual operating system will be back to as it was when it came out of the factory. And this means that it will wipe all of the apps that you have on the phone. It will wipe the access to sites that you've been to, your cache, your history, cookies that are on there, and also the account detail you've used to actually enter those apps. We have seen phones which haven't been wiped. Some vendors, Computer Exchange, wipe them before they sell them on to other people, but you're now leaving the account details and access to your accounts in the hands of the person that you've actually sold it to. So if you sell it on eBay or anything like that, really make sure that you wipe the device before you resell that on, just to make sure that you've cleared all of the account details that you had on there before.
Thanks, Steve. I'm going to put you on the spot now because we've got a question in the chat box that I'll pose to you about the use of public or work shared access Wi-Fi. So when we're out and about, we could log into Wi-Fi in a coffee shop, in a bar, in a shared services building. What are some of the issues there with people being able to access data through a shared Wi-Fi connection?
Okay, so there's a couple of different problems, well, a couple of different issues with either one of those. Public Wi-Fi networks, you really should avoid those wherever possible and use your phone's data connection if you need to connect to any service. So you see this in shopping centers, you go in or a shop, they offer you free Wi-Fi and you instinctively want to connect to that. You don't know who is behind those Wi-Fi networks. You don't even know if they are legitimate Wi-Fi networks for the shop and or the shopping center. So somebody could set up a hotspot pretending to be the shopping center to capture data that goes through those. I gave a presentation, a talk through to a police force in a Caribbean country before, where they had no idea that something like this was possible. And I had actually set up a hotspot in the back of the room. They finally cottoned on through part of that talk that I was giving to them, that while they were all a little bit bored of that, because cybersecurity wasn't their thing, it was a hot day and they just wanted to get out and do something, that they had connected to the hotspot which I'd set up and had been on Facebook and had been on Twitter And I was able to present them with the data that they actually had passed while they've been sat there in the room. You don't know who owns a public Wi-Fi network. If you absolutely must in need of an emergency, use a public Wi-Fi, it's absolutely compulsory idea, I would say, to use a VPN if you do need to connect to a public network. And what a VPN will do is it will essentially hide the traffic between your phone and your destination service website. If you need to open up online banking for something, you're in a store, you suddenly need to change money from one account to another, do not use a public Wi-Fi network to connect to in order to do that. Banking apps do have elements of security in there, but whenever you connect to a public Wi-Fi network, as we mentioned before, if you have a phone with fewer security updates, you haven't updated those, when you make a connection from your phone to the public Wi-Fi network, even before you've established a VPN connection to hide your data, your phone is still physically connected to that network, which means if it had been set up by somebody malicious, or if a hacker or somebody just very curious who was malicious was on the same network, will see your device and then be able to probe and try and take advantage of the vulnerabilities on your phone while you're connected to it. So absolutely use your phone vendors, your Vodafone, your O2's data connection rather than a public hotspot. Now at work, this depends on the usage policies that you would have. If you are allowed to use the work Wi-Fi, if they set up a Wi-Fi connection for employees to say, well, use the work Wi-Fi instead of using the corporate internet on your laptop to go out to use Facebook, absolutely fine if that's in accordance to the policies. But again, in that situation, I would always use a VPN. Always use a VPN to try and hide your traffic from whichever application or service that you're going to go to from anybody else apart from you and the destination service. It cuts down on a whole load of variables and middlemen situation.
Brilliant. And another question from me around passwords. I'm conscious as I'm about to say this, I don't think I've ever changed the password on my Facebook account, which must now be 10 years old at least.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Is not good practice, I guess. Are there any tips for listeners around passwords and what they should be using or not doing with their passwords?
Yes, it is easier said than done that you should change your passwords. There's been a shift in thinking because we're able to create more complex passwords. One of the things I would suggest is to get yourself a password manager on your phone, your laptop. What a password manager will do is it will store your account details for your Facebook, for your Twitter, for Sainsbury's, for Tesco's, for Netflix, for anything. And it will store it securely in a encrypted enclave on your device. And what that allows you to do is you can then use that password manager when you go to Facebook, for example. It will prompt you for your username and password. The password manager will intervene and say, I've got a record for you here for Facebook. I can then put in your username and your password. It will automatically fill it in for you. You don't have to type it. You press login and you go. This means that you're able to put in incredibly long, complex passwords that you would never remember. And you can put that into your password manager. And that will then push that into the credentials box for you when you go into that service. So it takes that step away of having to remember the complex password that you need to create. This is a very good way of having that and taking that aspect away from you. So I just see there's another question there. Is it difficult for hackers to hack into the password manager? It's not impossible. But there is a lot more engineering involved to do something like that. There are different types of password managers, some which exist purely on the phone, other ones which have a web interface where an attacker could want to attack that part to get access to your data rather than your phone. But yes, certainly the password manager, it alleviates far more problems than it actually presents. A recommendation. People do steer clear of making recommendations, but in all fairness, if you won't go far wrong if you were to look for some of the leading names in password managers. And then it comes down to a preference of how you like the look and feel, how it works for you as to which one you want to choose. You can look for LastPass. You can look for 1Password. You can look for Dashlane. Some of those, the leading brands, will do you a better service than not having one at all. There is an interesting, I'll put this one out there, is one which is free. Some of them do have limitations, but free is Buttercup. And I believe that works on Androids and iOS phones. That's something that you may want to take a look at and see which one works for you.
Steve, thank you so much. We're getting towards the end of this evening's session. It has been very, very informative. As last time, very, very practical in your advice and stuff that's grounded at real life issues that we're all facing. I know the students, and I can see in the chat box now, lots of people saying thank you for giving up your time and coming to speak to us. We will certainly think of an idea to get you back again to be the first ever third repeat guest for the First Intuition podcast. That would be fantastic. Enjoy the rest of your summer, Steve.
I will certainly try to, yes.
I'm left to wrap up the podcast for this evening, so I'm going to say thank you for the live audience, the students tonight. You've been great. You've asked really great questions of Steve and engaged brilliantly in the chat box. For the listeners to the podcast and the regular downloaders, I'm delighted to say we've now gone over 11,600 downloads for the podcast, which just really is phenomenal and blows my mind when I see the stats coming through for the download. So thank you for downloading. Continue to download. Steve mentioned social media influencers. If you do happen to be one, please mention the First Intuition podcast and share a link. We don't mind endorsements from anybody. If you've got time, write a review for the podcast. We really like to see what you're putting. It helps us as well get the message out there. I will wish you well. Thank you for listening and join me again for another episode of the First Intuition podcast.